Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Melissa Carvel-Zemer. It's my privilege to serve as the minister of this congregation. I'm joined in welcoming this morning by Max Grubb, who's one of our newest worship associates. Olive Hobbs will light our chalice this morning. And for those of you who are not aware, Olive is the longest tenured member of our congregation.
Our Unitarian heritage bids us light our chalice in the name of freedom, in the light of reason, in actions of tolerance. We gather in community to celebrate a heritage of freedom, reason, and tolerance.
From our past, we are called as individuals, a congregation, a movement. Into our future, we are called, imagining what might be from our vision of what should be. Right here, in this moment, we are called, with these particular people in this particular place. Will we hear the call? Do we hear the call? Let us hear the call. Our worship begins.
I was so happy to find this poem that I'm going to share with you this morning because it's the perfect poem to hear at this point in time when we're both looking backward and looking forward. And I was able to make some adaptations so that it's our very own. On and on and on. There was the time for all ages in church that day, so to the service the kids came along. They sat with their parents right in the pews, and they listened as the service went on. In one of the pews sat a small girl named Jane, yawning a little Jane yawn. And on the service went, and on and on, and on it went, and on and on, and on and on and on and on, and on and on and on. The first thing that came was singing a hymn, some music so peaceful, so calm. And Jane sat and wondered about this big church as the singing went on and on. Where did it come from, this grand old church, so large, so beautiful, and so strong? How did it get here? How was it built? How could it stand here so long? Some people must have started with an idea, a building to sing their life's song, and gave it their money, their love, and their hearts, and made it a place where all could belong. Amazing, she thought, as the reading began and went on and on and on, that the dream of those people could live with us now and be part of what we live upon. And then came the offering, where Hal played a long and beautiful song. And Jane was thinking just to herself, boy, asking for money sure takes long. And then she remembered the time she got sick. She was feverish and tired and drawn. And those people from church had kept calling and calling to see if her sickness had gone. It was kind of like church had come right to her house. Her mom and her dad sure felt cheered on. They talked for weeks about how good it was to have hope when they thought hope was gone. And then came the service, and it went on and 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 on. And Jane thought of her own town, with its beauty and pain, and the people in bad situations, the people in trouble in the country and state, in the county and in every nation. Some people are lucky. They've got families and friends and houses and kitchens and irons, but others are not. It just turned out that way. They've got little to trust or rely on. If I were in trouble, I hope I'd be helped, thought Jane. Whatever the reason, I hope that someone would see me and care, not ignore me like nobody sees them. But that's what they do, these folks in this church. I've seen them in every season. They sell fair trade coffee, collect toys at Christmas. They love them, they clothe them, they feed them. And as Melissa continued her sermon, Jane had a strange new sensation. She realized that church doesn't stop at these walls. It goes out in every direction. It's the work of real hands, the love of real hearts that make a church living and strong. The church is these people who shine with a light. They shine on and shine on and shine on. And on the sermon went, and on and on and on. And on this church will go. Come along, come along, come along.
As another September fades into memory, I offer you this September meditation. I do not know if the seasons remember their history or if the days and nights by which we count them remember their own passing. I do not know if the oak tree remembers its planting or if the pine remembers its slow climb towards sun and stars. I do not know if the squirrel remembers last fall's gathering or if the blue jay remembers the meaning of snow. I do not know if the air remembers September or if the night remembers the moon. I do not know if the earth remembers the flowers from last spring or if the evergreen remembers that it shall always stay so. Perhaps that is the reason for our births, to be the memory for creation. Perhaps salvation is something very different than anyone ever expected. Perhaps this will be the only question we will have to answer. What can you tell me about September? And we offer our congratulations to Christy Anderson, who has begun studies toward a master's degree at the New Seminary for Interfaith Studies. Throughout her course of study, Christy will continue her work as our commissioned lay leader. And when she's finished with her program, Christy plans to utilize her new skills, insights, and learning in her work with and on behalf of disadvantaged and marginalized people in our larger community. We wish Christy well in her new endeavors. And I invite you to join with me now in the spirit of prayer. Eternal Spirit of evolving creation, giving shape to galaxies, suns, stars and moons, and this very planet, giving life to dinosaurs and fish, orangutans and fireflies, taking the form of so many people through the long march of time, who in turn tapped the spirit of creation to shape the world around them. We follow in their footsteps. The spirit of creation dwells within us. Ours is the power to form something new. Let us be open to surprise. Let us be open to all that is our lives. Let us use all that we have been given, head and heart, hands and hope, to make something new and beautiful in this world. May it be so, and amen.
The Christian Inquirer devoted an article in 1857 to relations between Universalists and Unitarians. The author deplored the mutual distrust and recrimination that seemed to exist between the two. After all, the two groups were both branches of the one tree of liberal Christianity. Universalism was more the child of the heart. The first appeared among scholars, learned men, and the aristocratic classes of society, while Universalism was the offspring of the people at large and was deeply rooted in the democratic elements of the community. But regardless of their differences, or possibly because of them, they complemented rather than competed with each other. Both had a mission to uphold a new and better church, the church of the new world, In short, head and heart ought to work together.
The consolidation of the American Unitarian Association and the Universalist Church of America was a long time coming. Over 100 years before it finally came to fruition, leaders in both denominations foresaw their eventual union. Theologically, it made a lot of sense. Most early Unitarians were lowercase u Universalists, and most early Universalists were lowercase u Unitarians. Both denominations understood themselves to be proclaiming liberal religious values, but they differed in the way they expressed and embodied those values. The Unitarians emphasized human dignity, stressing human creation in God's image and human capacity for growth and development. Universalists proclaimed a message of universal salvation, stressing the unconditional and eternal love of God. 19th century adherents of each faith saw the ways in which their values and theology could complement one another, but theology wasn't the only factor under consideration. In the late 1850s, the prominent Unitarian minister and denominational institution builder Henry Whitney Bellows spoke in favor of a Unitarian and Universalist merger, while also observing that sociological differences between the two denominations presented major obstacles. Broad brush distinctions reveal the distance between the two. Unitarianism on our shores was first practiced by the wealthy elite in Boston and other urban areas. Universalism was strongest in rural areas and among the lower and middle classes. Most Unitarian clergy studied at Harvard Divinity School. Many early Universalist clergy were self-taught and ordained in response to their passion for the gospel. The constellation of churches here in Ohio in the mid-19th century reflects these distinctions. Almost all of the Unitarian churches were located in cities: Cleveland, Toledo, Columbus, Cincinnati, Dayton, and Youngstown. Taking away the Unitarian churches in those cities, there were only a small, very small handful in other parts of the state. Meanwhile, most of the Universalist churches were in villages and small towns. In Portage County alone, there were Universalist churches in Manaway, Brimfield, Aurora, Ravenna, Palmyra, and Kent. Though the messages of the Unitarians and Universalists were similar, major differences lie in how and to whom they expressed their message. As you might expect, there were plenty of Unitarians who thought that the Universalists were not cultured enough to join them, just as there were plenty of Universalists who were disdainful of the upper crust Unitarians. But there were also visionaries who could see that they belonged together. They paved the way. In 1878, the Unitarian and Universalist churches in Mukwonago, Wisconsin, voted to consolidate. In 1937, the two denominations cooperated in the publication of a new hymnal called Hymns of the Spirit. In 1951, the two youth groups held their first joint conference and 3 years later voted to consolidate ahead of the two denominations, forming a new entity called Liberal Religious Youth. Our own congregation seems to have favored partnership ahead of the curve. In 1930, the leaders of this congregation invited Horace Westwood, a Unitarian minister, to come conduct a preaching mission here in Kent. The congregation also raised the funds to purchase the new Hymns of the Spirit hymnal a few years after it became available. Finally, in recognition of widespread collaboration, the leaders of the two denominations agreed to appoint a joint merger commission in the middle of the 20th century. The commission devised a multi-part process, which included numerous publications outlining the pros and cons of consolidation, congregational conversations held in every Unitarian and Universalist congregation across the country, an initial advisory vote on a proposed consolidation plan in each congregation, which was then taken to an initial joint meeting of each body's general assemblies, and then a second decisive voting meeting held in each congregation to be subsequently ratified at a second joint meeting of each body's general assemblies. Those of you who have participated in our own congregation's annual meetings can imagine the tenor of the general assembly meetings those 2 years. After accepting the motion to discuss the consolidation plan, nearly 60 amendments were proposed, every single one of which had to be moved, seconded, discussed, and voted upon. And furthermore, since the bodies were meeting in separate sessions, every single wording change adopted by one body had to be concurred to by the other. As you might imagine, it was touch and go there for a while. There were several points upon which it was difficult to find consensus, mostly related to theology and to governance. One significant hang-up was the wording for the original Unitarian Universalist Statement of Principles. The traditional theists wanted a reference to God and to our Christian heritage. The Universalist theists wanted to acknowledge the great prophets and teachers of humanity in every age. And of course, the humanists wanted the statement to exclude mention of God. After several amendments and wording changes, the delegates hopefully considered a revision of the statement, which declared as their aim to cherish and spread the universal truths taught by the great prophets and teachers of humanity in every age and tradition, and immemorially summarized in our Judeo-Christian tradition as love to God and to man. They worked on it for a long time, and they were really hopeful, but it lost by 7 votes. Some people despaired of ever coming up with something that they could agree upon, and one prominent leader even went to bed only to find someone knocking on his hotel room door at 3:30 in the morning saying, "We think we've got it, come back, we're going to vote again." And so they did vote again on another revision with just one word change. Our Judeo-Christian tradition was changed to the Judeo-Christian tradition. And it made the difference. The motion passed. After several labored votes on other items, agreement on the plan was finally achieved. Back in the congregation, the plan was accepted 9-1 among Unitarians and 8-1 among Universalists. The delegates to the next General Assembly ratified the vote, and at long last, a new denomination was born. The first General Assembly of the new Unitarian Universalist Association was held in 1961. This summer will mark our 50-year anniversary. So it's a good time to ask ourselves, who have we been as a new denomination? Together, we've been learning what it means to be Unitarian Universalists. Our identity has been shaped by so many factors, not least of which was our experience with race and racism in the 1960s. In the middle of the 60s, the Unitarian Universalists from all across the country heeded Dr. Martin Luther King's call to go to Selma. The Reverend James Reeb and Viola Liuzzo were murdered there for their witness, and Unitarian Universalists across the country were catalyzed to join together and fight for the dream, equal voting rights for African Americans. Our moral compass tuned, our purpose clear, we were sure we were standing on the right side of history. It was a proud and triumphant moment for Unitarian Universalists. But within just a few years, the landscape changed, and we were no longer sure where we stood. There was significant disagreement about how to respond to the rise of Black power in the nation and in Unitarian Universalism. It's a long and complicated story that ends with many African American Unitarian Universalists walking away from the denomination. The heartache, confusion, and anger lingered for many years, during which we simply didn't engage with issues of race or racism. In the last 20 years, we've begun to imagine again what it would mean to be an anti-racist, anti-oppressive, multicultural community of faith. We still have a lot to learn. Who have we been? Our identity has been shaped in relationship to the larger culture and the many social change movements that unfolded in the last half of the 20th century. We responded to the sexual revolution by being the first denomination in the country to offer an honest and comprehensive sexuality education program to our youth. About Your Sexuality was the precursor to our award-winning Our Whole Lives sexuality education curriculum we use today. We responded to the gay rights movement by becoming one of the first United States denominations to open a National Office of Gay Concerns. That initial commitment has only grown clearer and stronger, making us among the religious leaders in advocating for equal rights for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people in our country today. We responded to the devastation of the war in Vietnam by risking the publication of the Pentagon Papers, which revealed the government's duplicity in initially gaining and then maintaining public support for the war. In making those papers public, Beacon Press took a risk for democracy that nearly 36 other publishers refused to take. Beacon Press continues to be a visionary and award-winning publisher committed to an independent publisher committed to producing books that promote values such as freedom of speech and thought, religious pluralism, and respect for diversity. We responded to the second wave of the women's movement by making room for the leadership of women, both lay and ordained. though influential female ministers were represented in both denominations' histories, as late as the 1970s, women made up only 2% of the Unitarian Universalist ministry. Today, women make up just slightly more than half of our ordained ministry. And it was women who led the charge to revise our principles in the 1980s. A significant part of the initial intent was to make the language inclusive, but along the way, a number of important theological refinements were made as well. In addition to separating and naming the several sources that our living tradition draws upon, the revised principles statement incorporated a new theological claim in affirming respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. I believe this claim, born out of a growing and common awareness that everything is inextricably interconnected, is part of the bridge that links who we have been to who we are becoming. 10 years before consolidation, Marian Franklin Ham wrote a hymn expressing her hopes for a united Unitarian Universalism. I invite you now to join together in singing her song in celebration of hope made manifest among us. Our hymn of affirmation is number 145, As Tranquil Streams. So who are we becoming? It turns out I had so much to say about our history that I'm going to have to consider that more fully on another Sunday. But I want to just sketch three concepts that I believe suggest the shape of the transformation we're living. I've heard several Unitarian Universalist thinkers suggest that our first principle is our heritage, while the seventh is our future. That makes a lot of sense to me. With our religious ancestors, we're concerned about the development of the individual's character and the salvation of the individual's soul. We have come to understand that the individual is not actually autonomous. Every single person's life is shaped and influenced by our common life in ways both profound and subtle. Therefore, it's not enough to limit ourselves and our concerns to questions of human dignity. We must also devote our attention to the whole health of the web which creates and sustains human life. The more we learn about the ways in which the integrity and quality of the whole has been sacrificed for individual gain, the more urgently we feel called to act. There's no way I can fund every solicitation that arrives in my mailbox, and yet I'm often moved to try to help stem the wanton killing of wolves, protect the forests, clean the rivers, defend the mountains, repair the ruined, feed the hungry, help the sick, stop the greed and the hate and the fear. I can't do it all, and what I can do is so very modest. I need religious community to remind me that I do not act alone. And I need religious community that can inspire me to persevere with hope, even when it's hard to imagine success or salvation. I hope we're becoming the kind of faith that helps the committed avoid cynicism and despair. I hope we're becoming the kind of faith that offers both solid spiritual grounding for action and deep spiritual wells for sustenance and renewal. To become that kind of faith, we'll need to continue to wrestle with essential theological questions. The Reverend David Bumba identifies three. What do we believe? Whom do we serve? And to whom or what are we responsible? I hope we're becoming the kind of faith that takes questions like these seriously. What do we believe? We have to be able to tell people what we affirm, not just what we disavow. Whom do we serve? We need to be willing to let go of any gods that are too small for us and this world we share. To what are we responsible? It's a question that matters if we're to live with faithfulness to something larger than our own egos. To David's question, I add the ones Shana raised in her essay. What makes us a church, and what differences does what we do make? Who are we becoming? I leave you with the questions. Today is Association Sunday. With other Unitarian Universalist congregations across the country, we're taking an offering this morning in support of the future of our faith. Our history is rich and our future full of promise. The money collected this morning will be used to provide programming in support of congregational life. We want our congregations to be healthy and vital communities of moral vision and effective action. We want our congregations to be multi-generational, multicultural communities in which we all find a welcome. We want our congregations to be places that offer spiritual substance. The Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations exists to serve the congregations. The money you contribute this morning will be used in part to developing programming to nurture congregational life.
our chalice be the light of justice. May our hearts be the burning within this chalice, bright as love in the distance. Only the work of justice is this light at the end of the tunnel. The road is long and the traveling slow. We don't have to walk this road all alone. Lord, I pray that every woman and man could be walking with a brother, holding hand in hand. Or maybe walking with a sister, holding hand in hand. May our chalice be the light of justice. May our hearts be the burning within this chalice, bright as love in the distance. Only the work of justice is this light at the end of the tunnel. We are one in the work and love. We make and we walk on till the work's done. And we make change as the road moves on. And the people on their way sing a joyful song. Well, everybody on your way, sing a joyful song. May our chalice be the light of justice. May our hearts be the burning within this chalice, bright as love in the distance. Only the work of justice is this light at the end of the tunnel. May our chalice be the light of justice. May our chalice be the light of goodness. May our chalice be the light at the end of the tunnel.
BR is a religion which, like sunshine, goes everywhere. Its temple, all space. Its shrine, the good heart. Its creed, all truth. Its ritual, works of love. Its profession of faith, divine living. Go in peace.